That brings us on to this question of immigrant rights and ethnic minority rights. And so I think I will just have time to get through that. I have about 50 slides on this. Now, what kind of rights would you imagine immigrants or ethnic minorities wanting? Well, obviously, the right to vote would be one, the idea. And this has been something which has a particular history in Britain, because when large numbers of people from India and Pakistan came over to England in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they had the right to vote immediately. And this has changed, I think, politics in Britain. As you know, in France this is not the case. In France, if you want the right to vote, you are obliged to take French nationality, which is sometimes difficult to get, but mostly it involves a particular choice which people aren't already or necessarily ready to take. So people come from another country and they want to stay here, but that doesn't mean they want to say, right, I'm not from this country anymore, I'm French. And in Britain, they, for accidental reasons, this was not necessary. That is, if you came from India and Pakistan or other colonies, because the ideology of the British Empire was, we are all under the same queen, we are all equal. Now, this wasn't true, but this was the ideology. And that meant that they automatically had the right to vote when they arrived. This makes a big difference, and I think this is probably one of the reasons that multiculturalism went much further in Britain. Because when people can vote, you have to listen to them. In some towns, you could have, 10, 20% of the population came from India and Pakistan. Who votes? Well, you listen to people who vote, because that's the way it works. Ethnic diversity, nothing new in Britain, and people have come to Britain for many different reasons. If we go right back, they could come in as settlers, just like the Celts or the Saxons. Hostile invaders, the Romans who go home after 400 years, the Vikings, Scandinavians, and the Normans. When the Normans came originally, they're almost like the French, really, aren't they? Of course, you have people who came to Britain as refugees. A big wave of Jewish refugees at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Sorry. This was a time when being Jewish in Russia was dangerous, and England looked like an attractive place to be, even though the people who arrived often did not speak English. They spoke Yiddish. And it's very scary to go to another country where you don't even speak the language, but it was just so dangerous. The French Huguenots, at certain periods when the Huguenots are repressed in France, they come over to England, which is a little bit more welcoming. Sometimes people come to England as skilled workers, French weavers, German mining engineers, Italian glass manufacturers, Dutch canal builders, etc. This goes back a long way. When they built the cathedrals in the 12th century, they imported experts from other parts of Europe. This goes back a long way. Here you have some historical views of immigration. William Hogarth, then, there on the left. So William Hogarth, artist, engraver of the 18th century, extremely influential. I mean, one of the great ones. And he is being very positive about the French immigrants. The French Protestant immigrants are shown to be... where are they? Are shown to be clean and polite and well-dressed, whereas the others are they are being rude. They are being sexual, which you're not supposed to be, and poverty, squalor, and sexual immorality. This is a symbol of sexual immorality over here. So this is the French Protestants. The French Protestants in the 18th century, who were not feeling too safe in France. They came over to Britain, and they were particularly skilled in textile manufacturing, in particular silk, la soie. And here you have them carrying out their trade in London. So that's just one example of local reactions to immigrant arrival. Now, of course, local reactions to immigrant arrival are very varied and might include integrating culture, for example, Indian food. Indian food is more popular in Britain now than fish and chips. It actually is more popular, yes. One reaction is to welcome some elements. Bhangra music come from India. Extremely popular reggae music. So this is one reaction. Of course, another reaction, which is much less fun, is racism, which will always have an event. I'm fairly confident you wouldn't make this mistake, but one of my third-year students last week made a mistake in trying to say that when there is immigration, when there is more immigration, there is automatically more racism. And this is not true. In fact, it's easy to measure. This is not true. As you know, in France, if you find, I know it's a silly thing to do, but if you try to find the most racist town in France, it will not be the town with the most coloured people. Because it's about something else. It goes on in people's heads. And in fact, very often, you can have completely white places which are completely racist. Certainly in Britain, I as you know, I studied the First World War. Very, very few black people in Britain. And the anti-black racism is absolutely massive. There's no necessary link. It's much more complicated than that. Yeah, it's a reaction to many different things. I just wanted to mention it because, like I say, one student fell into this. Sometimes, après j'ai oublié le texte. Oh right, okay. The other reason they could come into the country was because they were important for the country's economies. One example would be financiers from the north of Italy. Another example, of course, why would people come to England? As a consequence of wars in Europe, there were large numbers of Belgian refugees in the First World War came to England, because of course Belgium was a hard place to be. The pop songs of the time made the most of this, and there are love songs of, you know, my lovely little refugee girl, yeah, about falling in love with a refugee. It's very 1918, really. Of course, also people came to England to fight in the war. Over a million men from India and Africa came to England to go to France to fight. In the First World War. So this makes an enormous difference, yes, that wars really move people around and also change the way they see the world. In World War II also, huge involvement of men and women from the West Indies, Africa, India, and many smaller Commonwealth nations. So those were big movements of people into Britain from foreign parts, and in particular from foreign parts where people look different. Of course, we also have another reason that people came to Britain is when they were not asked their opinion and would be brought in as slaves or servants, mostly from the British colonies, Jamaica and Barbados in particular, from the West Indies, or from India. And here you see a painting of Lady Mary Montagu and her servant in the 18th century. We don't know if it's a servant or a slave. We don't know. It could be one or the other. And of course, in the very rich elites, in the very rich elites, to have servants who were from a long way away and exotic was to show how important you were. Some more artistic productions which reflect this fact. Here you have Le mariage à la mode de Quatre, la toilette. Pourquoi c'est en français le titre quand c'est en anglais qu'il a fait? Should have said Bob. But you see there is a black gentleman behind. And here is another one. Yes, here you have just an example of in 1821, where you have a party, a drawing of a party, and they include black people and white people dancing together. And so the history goes back some distance. The biggest waves, the first two big waves, the thing is that the obviously population is rising, and after the Industrial Revolution you get much bigger waves of immigrants. The first big wave is the Irish, because one, it's not very far, you can go home every winter if you like. And so very, very typically in the 18th century to build the canals, and in the 19th century to build the railways, the Irish came over. The Irish were also, Irish women were massively in demand for as domestic servants. They had a very good reputation. And the second big wave is this one, which you can see in front of you. In the 1890s, mass migration affected Britain with the arrival of large numbers of refugees, mainly Jews, escaping from Russia, because this is a time when there were regular massacres of Jews in Russia. Now, when they arrived in England, the situation was much better, but nevertheless, it was not. It was pretty hard. I was reading recently an autobiography of a man who explained when he was a child in Manchester in 1907, and he said he saw local people attack the house of a Jewish family and burn the house, and the police just watching, happily watching. That's in Britain in 1907. I don't mean to say it was everywhere, but it was very, very strong anti-Semitism at the time. And there you have the wave of Jewish immigrants between 1880 and 1914. The Jewish community rose from 60,000 to 300,000. Before 1880, there was already, for hundreds of years, a Jewish community in Britain. And some of the Jews whose families had been in Britain for a long time were very unhappy with the new mass migrations of poor Jews. As they said, you know, anti-Semitism will get worse if there are hundreds of thousands of poor Jews arriving. That's how the calculation they made. Because as we know, solidarity is not automatic. People don't automatically, or life would be simpler if it was. So here we have, again, this is Punch magazine, yes. It still exists today, Punch magazine. But it was particularly influential at the time. Here you have the Russian wolf and the Hebrew lamb. I'm not sure if I really understand what's happening here. It's commenting on the persecution of Jews in Russia. There's the Russian wolf and the Hebrew lamb. Can you understand what's happening there? I ought to look more carefully at my sources before I bring them into class, shouldn't I? I guess that this is supposed to be the Jewish man here. The Russian wolf and the Hebrew lamb. Okay. One of the political... there were many different reactions to the rise of the Jewish community in Britain. It was very concentrated in the East End of London. There were places where for 10 or 12 streets, everything you heard was in Yiddish, or the writing was in Yiddish, the newspapers were in Yiddish, it was a theatre, and they set up theatres as well. It was a very thriving community, very active community. Trade unions for the, it's mostly they made clothes. So les tailleurs juifs du l'Est de Londres. Very poor, especially at the beginning, extremely poor, even poorer than the poor in Britain. And here is one of the hostile political reactions when the Member of Parliament, William Evans Gordon, formed the British Brothers League in 1902. So you can see the name here, the British Brothers League. So British, obviously, to underline that, you know, we are not foreigners. And brothers, you know, it's the idea of the fraternity of us against the others. And they tried to lobby the governments to act against this migration. Here you have an extract from a newspaper. A great public demonstration under the auspices of the British Brothers League in favour of restricting the further immigration of destitute foreigners into this country will be held at the People's Palace, Mile End, Tuesday, January the 14th, 1902. Okay, so what's interesting about this is everybody knows that they're talking about Jews, but it doesn't say in the advert Jews. Yeah? So there's a obviously they're not too happy to publicly announce a campaign against Jews. So they say destitute. The problem is poor foreigners. The second thing is that it is going to be addressed by members of Parliament, members of the Board of Guardians of all shades of politics from all the different political parties, and ministers of religion of all denominations, yeah, Anglicans, Methodists, Catholics, etc. Now, of course, this is the advert. It may not be completely true. It's an advert. But nevertheless, they must have had two or three people from different political parties, and so they are attempting to present this. This is not political. It is defending British people against against invasion. Now, this is historic because it will lead to the first ever law against immigration in Britain, to restrict immigration. Before 1902, anybody who wanted to come to Britain was allowed to come to Britain. And mostly people didn't come because they wanted to stay at home. Yeah? And the big movements were a new idea. The big movements were a new phenomenon. And here is the law in question, the 1905 Aliens Act. The 1905 Aliens Act, the first legislative attempt to control the immigration flow, inflow. Say, you can only come if. Put conditions on it. Now you can see that this was rather a surprising idea to people at the time. So you stop people, why? A lot of people were very confused about it. And here you have a critical cartoon. This is Britannia, of course the symbol of Britain, reading the Aliens Act, this new law. And she says, I can no longer offer shelter to fugitives. England is not a free country. Je n'ai plus le droit de proposer un abri aux réfugiés. L'Angleterre n'est plus un pays libre. Now, unfortunately, we don't have the we know where we got it from. We got it from the Jewish Museum, but we don't have the information there of who was drawing this and saying this. But we can see there was some criticism of this idea, and so here the idea is that stopping immigrants from coming to Britain is against the traditions of British freedom. That's what they're saying in this particular cartoon. And here we have a drawing of the immigration courtroom. So it's like you have to go before a judge, a magistrate, to decide if you are allowed to immigrate into Britain or not. Many of the people who arrived in Britain were hoping to go to America. But it has to be said, this is the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. These are very simple people. They don't know exactly where America is. Yeah? There were many cases of transport selling people a ticket. I'll take you to America, and leaving them in Liverpool and saying, there you are, you're in America. Because it sounds very strange for us at the moment, but you know, people who don't speak the language, who have no choice, and they suddenly find themselves in Liverpool and they think they're in America. So I imagine New York is bigger than that, you know. So the immigration officials were allowed to refuse entry to those they decided were unsuitable. So very general criteria. I don't have the details of the exact conditions, but the important thing is that this is the first law which limits immigration. Some people can come in and other people cannot come in. Even the Act itself, the Alien Act, aujourd'hui on utilise alien pour dire extraterrestre, c'est pour vous dire un peu l'ambiance. The 1905 Act also established a legal basis for those seeking political or religious asylum. Donc il a défini l'asile politique, qu'est-ce que c'est? So that was something which was a right, a very modern right, the right to asylum. But this same act also allowed people to be deported. You could be, if you were an immigrant, you could be sent back to the country you came from for the first time. Previously, this was not possible. Previously, if you came from Russia and you were in Britain and you were accused of a crime, you could be imprisoned like everybody else, but you couldn't be sent back to your country. It also raised the question in the modern world, what does that mean, British nationality? And this question of nationality will become more important with the rise of the welfare state. Because, of course, in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, people who came to Britain, well, good luck, you have a chance of finding a job or something. In the 20th century, more and more, the government has accepted responsibility to give a little money to people who are very poor. And so, obviously, the question of who has the right to have healthcare and welfare becomes more important. And so the question of nationality becomes more important because there are more advantages to have nationality. And this is solved, or the definition is made by the 1914 law, the British Nationality and Status of Aliens. The definition of British nationality was changed over the course of the 20th century, but this is the first important act, the 1914 British Nationality and Status of Aliens Act. Just to ruin the suspense, they will change the idea of nationality again when the crisis starts in the 70s and they no longer want any Indian or Pakistani or anybody from the British Commonwealth to move in automatically. So the 1914 Act confirmed that to be British, you had to be born on British soil. This included the Empire. So it has to be said that although, in my personal opinion, the Empire was generally very negative, it's true that it did allow Indian and Pakistani people to move to Britain and have the same rights as everybody else for a certain period. So it's a slight positive thing. Be born on British soil, including the Empire, or have a British father. Mother is not important. Okay, you mother. What's important about mothers anyway? Okay, and finally, owe allegiance to the crown. Don't tell my mother I said that. Owe allegiance to the crown. So that's a definition there. The attitude of the British to nationality, or the British establishment, or the British elite to nationality, is still rather unusual because in a British passport, not in other passports, but in a British passport, it says inside, Her Britannic Majesty requests and requires all those whom it may concern to let the bearer pass without let or hindrance. That is to say, Sa Majesté demande et exige à toute personne concernée. Demande et exige. We have still the Empire in the text, yeah. So, whereas no other passports from other countries have this idea of, you know, I am the Queen and you will let my subjects pass, or things will be hard for you. So we still have that sort of attitude, and even. In connection with dual nationality, for example, I have British nationality, and if I want to have French nationality, which I do, but they ask for so many papers. But if I ask for French nationality, people ask me, in that case, do you lose your British nationality, or must you demand dual nationality? And in fact, as I understand it, the situation is that I don't even have to inform the British government if I take French nationality. Because the British establishment has no interest in other nationalities. It's just not important, that sort of stuff, yeah? Whereas a lot of countries have conditions about dual nationality and so on. The British are... This is the arrogance. So here we have a 1914 cartoon. I am Irish, I can't read this. Born and bred in Scotland, I was. I see. Yes, I see the thing, yes. These are people pretending to be British. So this gentleman is obviously, he's Jewish, because you can see, because he's a tailor. He's a bit Jewish. He said, born and bred in Scotland, I was. Yeah? And so he has a very heavy Jewish Eastern European accent, and he's pretending to be Scottish, you see, and so on. Both my parents were Welsh. Welsh were. Oh yeah, German. Nein. Both my parents Welsh were. It's a fairly standard thing. Yeah, I am Irish. I can't see the rest of it. Alien. Nein. Pure English. I play. Everyday. Quelque chose everyday. Yes. Okay. These are people suddenly pretending to be British because of the new law. Okay. It's a commentary of the time. The other possibility, of course, is to be naturalized. That is to ask for British nationality. The 1870 Naturalization Act required applicants to have been resident in Britain for 5 years. Say again? There you go. Okay, fine. we're still talking about the 1905 law, sorry, the 1914 law. And in 1914, when they make a law about nationality, they don't feel any necessity to treat men and women in the same way. And so the situation is quite different for women. Anybody who marries a British man, any woman who marries a British man, automatically becomes British. But any British woman who marries a foreigner takes on her husband's nationality. Okay, so this is unsurprising in the laws of the time. The wife is considered to be a subordinate thingy, a subordinate element. This is the 1914 law, yes? Now, this is the 1914 law, Nationality Act. So, again, it's original in that it is the first time they feel the need to define in detail exactly what is it being British. And this is because of the modern world, which means larger groups of people want to move around the world. There's more trade, there's more possibilities, and so there's more legal framework to put them in. The outbreak of the First World War caused a particular problem in that they wanted to be sure. Rappelez-vous, il n'y a pas la sécu à l'époque, alors il y a pas, tout le monde n'a pas le niveau de sécu. Il n'y a évidemment pas de carte d'identité. Il n'y en a encore pas aujourd'hui en Angleterre, c'est pour dire. So the problem they have during the war is they want to be kept. Are there Germans here? There were a lot of Germans living in England in 1914. The two countries were very close. They were cousins. The royal family were cousins. Very, very, very close. The Germans spoke good English. German music, German band music, was very popular in Britain. They were very, very close. And this is one of the reasons why, psychologically, the First War was very violent, because the two countries were very close. And so the Aliens Restriction Act was passed, which placed limits on the activities of all aliens and required foreign nationals to register with the police and allowed for their deportation. There were a lot of problems during the First World War. German shops were often attacked and burnt. Even if the German people had been in England for 20 years. Also, there's quite a hysterical panic, and quite often people who were not German, but had a name that sounded a little bit German, suddenly found that, you know, their shops were burnt and they were attacked, and so on. The singers who appeared on stage in the music hall, if they had a German-sounded name, they changed their name. And you would see people have on their door if they were Swiss or from other German sounding name, but German, they would put copies of their documents on the door so that people wouldn't attack them. I mean, the First World War was extremely, obviously extremely violent, and people were reacting in very emotional ways. The end of the war and the 1919 Aliens Act adds further restrictions, in particular on the question of foreign sailors in British merchant ships. This act was partly a reaction to riots in Liverpool and elsewhere, where British sailors rioted against black sailors who were being employed on their ships. And it was a racist disorder, and this was one of the results. And here we have again Hazelden in 1920 about the idea of a passport. How difficult it must be to organize a passport system. This, of course, has continued to cause problems. Only recently, only 10 years ago, passports were much simpler. And as you know now, they have some very, very computer chip and all sorts of things. They've had to advance the technology recently. And this is the question of, we as English gentlemen traveling for pleasure. So they are obviously not English. And the official says, yes, yes, yes. Yeah. The photograph on our passport is not us because the photographer made a mistake. Okay, yeah, quite satisfactory. Yeah. The names are given as Bolshevich and Murderersky, but that is a mistake. We are Brown and Robertson. Quite all right. Okay, so that's the for men, the situation is very, very easy. However, English, you don't look English. These are photographs of two pretty women. They are not of you. Arrest these women. Question them. Search them. Now, it's a joke, of course. It's a joke of the some of the reflections on the passport system. And this is Hazelden again. We've chosen just five or six very famous cartoonists to go into this. This is something I just mentioned. Violence against foreign seamen, and in particular black seamen, broke out in British ports during the summer of 1919. African, Indian and West Indian seamen. People looking for adventure often. Further unrest accompanied the 1920 Aliens Order and the 1925 Special Restriction Coloured Alien Seamen Order. So here, this is something very particular. The 1925 order, amongst it, an order from a government department, is not a law exactly. And this is very specific because this order, even in its title, says we are worried about coloured alien seamen. So it's this doesn't worry anybody at the time. You know, it's not there is no anti-racist culture in the 20s. One of the problems they had is that quite a lot of British people, sailors who were black, were registered as aliens anyway. Yeah, so this question of it was not acceptable to be black British in the 1920s. There was another example in the 1930s, an example of a racist law. The 1935 British Shipping Act, and this is that ships were given subsidies if they employed British, meaning white seamen. C'est-à-dire que le gouvernement donnait des subventions aux entreprises qui promettaient d'engager que des blancs. Okay. So this is 1935, yeah. But this is it's important to see these things because one of the big mistakes we make as 21st century people is to imagine that racism 70 years ago was like today. Mostly, the prejudices were mostly a minority, a very annoying minority, but a minority. This was not the case. It was more or less generalized. With World War II and in the years following, demand for labor grew. This is the post-war boom, Les Trente Glorieuses. We are rebuilding Britain at the end of the Second World War. A quarter of the buildings in London have been damaged by bombs. What's more, we are not going to close down the military industry, but continue building arms in the 50s and 60s, the nuclear weapons and others. All of the developed countries will maintain a military budget much higher than in any peacetime previously, the arms race and so on. And at this time, migration to the United Kingdom was encouraged. Enoch Powell, who is later famous for his racist speech, went to Jamaica, I think it was Jamaica or Barbados, and recruited black men to come and work on the buses and in the hospitals in London. On dit l'argent n'a pas de couleur. It's a matter of. So migration was actually encouraged. They had passed the 1948 British Nationality Act, and this said that any Commonwealth subject, so anybody from the colonies, if they wanted to become British, they could. This is 1948. Yeah, this is the, from the point of view of immigrants, this is the golden age. Anybody who wanted to register as a British citizen was entitled to, from 1948 until, for 20 years, I think, approximately. And between 1948 and 1962, about 280,000 people from the British West Indies, Jamaica, Trinidad, and another place which I can't remember anymore. About 280,000 people from the British West Indies settled in the UK. Very often, they worked in the hospitals and on the buses. It seems to be a general rule in this period that the public sector is a little bit less racist than the private sector, and so it was easier to get a job in the hospitals and the buses than in the private companies. Although you do get quite a lot of West Indians in the car factories. Remember, the 1950s is car factories, almost for the first time, because it's mass production of cars and so on. And so about 280,000 people from the British West Indies settled in the United Kingdom. I think I may have mentioned this before, I'm not quite sure. The Windrush, yes. And the symbolic ship. On a déjà parlé du Windrush ou non? Okay, good. J'ai fait différents cours avec différentes années. Je me confonds. The Windrush is a symbol. It's one of the ships which brought a lot of West Indian immigrants to Britain in 1948. And in fact, so the Windrush, it's a ship, yeah, was travelling from Australia to Britain when it's made a stop at Kingston Harbour in Jamaica in 1948. And before it her arrival, the major newspaper in Jamaica, the Daily Gleaner, le glaneur journalier, c'est pas mal comme titre pour un journal, had run adverts encouraging Jamaicans to take advantage of the cheap passage to work in Britain. So there was a official government encouragement, local government, and the Empire Windrush, which arrived, was the symbol. It was the first big ship with a lot of immigrants. Many of the immigrants from the West Indies had a bit of a shock when they arrived, because when they'd been to school in Jamaica, they learnt that, you know, that the empire was wonderful and that Jamaicans and British people were equal and so on. Very often, when they arrived in England and found racism, they weren't expecting it at all. It was a complete surprise. They lived in Jamaica, they didn't see any racists. There are many autobiographies written about this, where it's quite a shock. A little later than the next big wave is between 1955 and 1962. About 76,000 Indians and 70,000 Pakistanis, mostly men, settled in Britain. And the new West Indian and Asian immigrants often received a cool welcome from the British population. Certainly, I think that's a fair comment. Of course, not everybody in Britain was a horrible racist. And very frequently you got reactions where people would have racist ideas in general, but would be very positive to the coloured people who lived in their streets, because that's how it can work sometimes. But certainly institutionally it was very long. The trade unions were not really interested in immigrant workers for until the 1970s, really, in general. Of course, there were a few interested, but there are cases where immigrant workers went on strike and the trade unions were not interested, and it's just a tribal conflict, yeah? So sort of racist stereotyping, even from the trade unions. Although, once the trade unions understood that they had everything to lose by separating off Indians and Pakistanis and West Indians and keeping them outside the unions, then the attitude changed in the 1970s. And today, trade unions are, in my opinion, probably the most active institutions against racism. In a way, because they're kind of obliged to be, because if you work in a big hospital and you have a white union and then all the coloured people are not in a union, then everybody loses, so they have an interest in getting involved. Here you have a 1955 cartoon by Michael Cummings, which shows a more positive view about immigration. Here you see, in the middle of the 19th century, the British man sending his son off to the colonies to be an administrator in India, for example, to have a good job, a middle-class job, but in the colonies, and saying, "Good, but look, boy, go out and seek your fortune." And 100 years later, according to this cartoonist, it is the West Indian sending his boy off to Britain. "Good luck, boy, go out and seek your fortune." Now, this drawing can be interpreted in various ways, but one way of interpreting is that he's being quite positive about the immigrants, saying, "Well, you know, they're doing just what we did before." That's how I interpret it. Although, of course, when you arrived, it's not the same situation. Of course, he arrives to a good job and local servants, whereas the other gentleman will not. Here we have the question of racial prejudice. Racial prejudice against ethnic minority people started to grow. C'est pas moi qui ai écrit started to grow. Je suis pas trop d'accord parce qu'il y en avait déjà beaucoup. So here on the left, you can see a very typical example of an advert. Yeah, three rooms, kitchen and bathroom, married couple only, no coloured. Okay, and of course, at this time in the 1950s, this is not illegal at all. It's not a legal problem at all. This was certainly people being publicly and loudly racist was much more common, even when I was a child. Yes. In the 1970s, when I was at school, racist jokes were every day. It was just something you heard every day. This was not, nobody knew any black people. That wasn't considered to be necessary. It was just every day. 50 years later, I wanted to give an example. 50 years later, this is a photograph which I took last month. Southall, which is a train station in the south of London, and the sign is in two languages, Southall in English and underneath in Punjabi. Okay, so this is quite an interesting example of multiculturalism in Britain, which in many ways, in certain symbolic ways, has gone much further than in France. I think it is impossible to imagine that in France the name of the station would be written in French and Arabic. It just would not happen in France. Because the attitude to languages is different. So that's the extreme. So this doesn't mean that everything changed, but certainly many, many things changed. And multiculturalism, now this is a word you have to be very careful with, because it means 100 things to 100 people. But certainly, multiculturalism has gone further in Britain. For example, where my mother lives, in a small town in the north of England, the 40,000 people in the town. If you go into the public library, about 10% of the books are not in English, they're in Punjabi, novels and so on. And this would be automatic, you know, Punjabi, Gujarati, etc. And the signs in the hospitals will be in several languages. That would be considered to be automatic. Perhaps this is partly because the English are so bad at other languages that they kind of understand. I don't know. In any case, it's true to say that there was pressure for immigration control, even though at this time there is no unemployment. This is the time in the 1960s. I may have already told you the story, but the foreman at my father's work was a bit of a bastard. And one day he ordered my father to do something, and my father said, "No, I don't want to. I resign." And he got another job on Monday. He left his job on Thursday, and he got another job on Monday. Now, that makes things very different. Yeah, it doesn't work anymore. Okay, yeah. But that was the atmosphere. That was the atmosphere. And so, little by little, the foreman, les contremaîtres, ils apprenaient à se tenir à carreau, because otherwise they lose their people. And the of course, the top manager is angry with the foreman. So it was a very interesting period. So pressure for immigration control, in any case, was growing, and they passed a law in 1962. Said that's the end. Yet from 1948 to 1962, any Commonwealth person could come to Britain. But after 1962, it got more difficult. They introduced an employment voucher system. That is to say, you want to come to England, you can come if you can do a job which we need people for. Yeah. So it's a classic example. And here you have the Daily Mail cartoon, the British Commonwealth Hotel. They're saying, you know, on a plus de place pour vous. But it's interesting because the title is No Room at the Inn. What is the reference? Who was refused at the inn at this time of year? Say again? This is about coloured people in Britain. But the title No Room at the Inn is a reference to a much more famous story from this time of year that you all know, where two Jewish parents, Mary and Joseph, went to Bethlehem with their new... Was it Bethlehem? Yeah, with their new... Well, not with their new baby. Not yet the baby. And they were looking for somewhere to stay in Bethlehem and said, no, there's no room at the inn. And so what did they do? They went to a stable, and the little baby Jesus was born in the stable with the horses and so on. Vous avez déjà entendu cette histoire? Oui, vous avez déjà encore avec moi? Ok, on me regarde là. Yes, ok. So that's interesting, because the cartoon is suggesting that refusing these black people coming into Britain is like those people who refused Jesus. So it's a very positive view of immigration in this picture. So really, it's not a moral situation. And here is the opposite. No, it's not the opposite at all. This is story of the Conservative government. Six 600,000 immigrants admitted to Britain by the Tory government. Is this cartoon positive about immigration or negative? It's rather negative, isn't it? Here is the Prime Minister who's inviting this person who is much bigger than him, and also I think is a sort of stereotype of little me and big powerful him. You know, I think it's negative about, yeah. Et donc c'est le Premier ministre conservateur qui dit et dire qu'il y a des gens qui disent que les conservateurs sont contre les gens de couleur. Okay. Important. So it's an ambiguous cartoon. Cartoons are often ambiguous. You know, people don't normally want to open their newspaper and see direct political propaganda of the left or the right, because it's a bit boring. Yeah. So we like to see cartoons which are political but a little bit ambiguous. Yes. So we're not sure who is the enemy here. Yeah. It could be the immigrants. It could be the conservative prime minister who's naive and so on. This law was not enough, and there was a new Commonwealth. Was not considered enough by the people who opposed immigration, and a new Commonwealth Immigrants Act was passed in 1968, which made it harder for British nationals from East African countries to come to Britain. So increasing the limitations. And Enoch Powell is famous, of course, for his famous speech, but the other thing which became a controversy for a while, but now has disappeared, is that you would have sections of the right-wing parties calling for the repatriation. C'est-à-dire, pas seulement il ne faut pas laisser venir plus d'immigrés, mais ceux qui sont déjà ici, il faudrait les renvoyer chez eux. That's a repatriation. This is something which is no longer, which is very a tiny minority today. But when Enoch Powell said it, he could get a significant minority to support him. Even in the Sunday Telegraph, which is a very conservative newspaper, Enoch Powell, on ne le reconnaît pas par la moustache, Enoch Powell is presented as in a very negative way. Donc ici, il ne voit plus rien, Enoch Powell, parce qu'il est aveuglé par son idée de rapatriement des immigrés. And he is... this is a quotation from Enoch Powell. Re-emigration, as profoundly humane as it is far-sighted. Il n'y a rien de plus humain ni de visionnaire que de renvoyer les immigrés à leur pays. Okay. And the end of the primary immigration comes with the Immigration Act of 1971. Primary immigration, that means people who come who do not already have family in England. Yeah. Primary immigration is, very often young men who want to come to England to work. Whereas secondary immigration is when you live in England and you have a job and you've got a flat, and so you phone your wife and children, you say, oh, I want you to come too. That's secondary immigration. Regroupement familial, comme on dit. And there you have a very negative view of immigration. Also in the Sunday Telegraph, where the immigrants are represented as a tidal wave, a dangerous tsunami. And it's also a joke because this is taken from a Japanese work of art which was sold at the same time. Yeah, so it's but obviously that's a very negative view. By the end of the 1970s, immigration from the new Commonwealth, India, Pakistan, etc., was already under strict control. But a new British Nationality Act was passed in 1981 to reduce future sources of primary immigration, and the 1981 Act went backwards in comparison with the 1948 Act, because you were no longer a British national if you were a Commonwealth subject. Yeah, so they removed a right there. Now, when we say that primary immigration stopped in 1971, that is only true for India, Pakistan, the West Indies, and so on. There are two sources of primary immigration which continue until today. The first one is not a large group of people. It's that if you're rich, you can come anyway. If you're really rich, it's no problem. You just arrive, and the second one, which is larger numbers of people, is the European Union. Because now the European Union is quite big, since the new countries who joined, Poland, Romania, Hungary, etc. And England is very attractive. England is very attractive for a number of reasons. First of all, they may well already speak English and learn it in Poland, so that makes it much easier. And in the last 10 years, 500,000 Polish people have come to Britain, for example. Now, many of them stay a few years and then go back to Poland. But they sometimes stay longer. Many of them send money home to Poland because with the money you can earn in McDonald's in London, it's worth a lot of money in Poland. A very classic sort of situation. There are different attitudes around the Poles and the Eastern Europeans, but I know a lot of English people who say, well, the advantage of the Poles and the Czechs and so on, who work in a lot of shops and cafes in London now, really a lot, you notice them every time you go, and I have several of my English friends say, well, they're much more friendly than the English people who used to work there, which is partly true. There's a very upbeat sort of tide. My mother is delighted about immigration these last few years, which is very unusual because she's a very conservative lady, but she's delighted because they are Polish. Why does she like Polish people coming to England? Good idea, but actually, it's because my mother is Catholic, and the Catholic churches were getting more and more empty, and now they're full. Now they're full. They really are full. Well, I'm exaggerating, but they're full. So, of course, when my mother goes to church and there's a lot of people, well, it's much more fun when there's a lot of people. So she's very pleased. I never thought I'd see my mother being happy about immigration, but you know, everything can happen. Right. Oh, the other element which ought to be taken into account is refugees. And today, quite a number of refugees from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Libya, or in Britain. As you know, the different wars and dreadful situations around the world, there are many good reasons to be a refugee. Refugees had been admitted to Britain in small numbers since the end of World War II. Also, at the beginning of World War II, Belgian refugees and sometimes Jewish refugees, although the British government was not very happy about admitting Jewish refugees. A lot of Jewish children got to Britain at the end of the 1930s. In fact, in the beginning of the 1940s. In fact, in Eastern Europe, it was not uncommon for Jewish parents to give their child to any English person who was going by there, because they really understood that it was so dangerous that they preferred to give their child. And there were hundreds and hundreds of Jewish children who just arrived in London because a tourist brought them back, because they understood what was happening. You know, dreadfully traumatic situations. But the number of refugees and asylum seekers started to increase in the 1980s and 1990s. Quite a lot of these would be illegal immigrants. Very often, Afghan refugees will end up in London. Why are they interested in England? Two reasons. First reason is speak English, which is most of them speak more English than French, you know, for example. But the second reason is there are no identity cards in Britain. So if the police come up to you in the streets, well, they don't. They never ask you for your identity card. And this is an interesting question because I think I mentioned to you the British government wanted to introduce identity cards, but it's politically impossible. Nobody wants them. Not enough people want them. And so what they did a few years ago, about 10 years ago, is they said, well, what we'll do is we'll introduce identity cards on a voluntary basis. Donc des cartes d'identité facultatives. L'idée étant de habituer les gens à l'idée pour après les rendre obligatoires, bien sûr. Mais bon. It just didn't work. You know, who will voluntarily go and have an identity card? But it's very British, is that? And when I say, I may have told you this already, but when I say to my British friends, in France everybody has an identity card, my British friend says, oh, a fascist country. Okay. Because it's absolutely impossible to imagine. The British attitude is, here is a policeman, he doesn't know who I am. That's his problem, not my problem. If he wants to know who I am, he can ask me. I will tell him. I'm British. That's very so. It's a rather strange mentality. It's true. I quite like it. I must admit, I'm not a nationalist in general, but I do like the no identity cards. Now there has been a series of laws about asylum seekers and new economic migrants. So asylum seekers, people who are leaving their country for because the political situation or the war, and new economic migrants, people looking for a better life. And there have been a lot of laws about this, and you can see there are still newspapers who will print very negative views of immigrants. Yeah, look at this. Immigration, welcome to the UK. Here are the immigrants arriving. Okay. And what is this?
Benefits.
Yeah. What kind of benefits? Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Allocation chômage, prenez un formulaire ici. Yeah. Okay. So obviously a very very negative view. In the Sun, Charles Griffin, another of the a very conservative cartoonist. But very good at drawing cartoons. Yeah, that's talent. Talent is not reserved to good politics. Okay, now, I haven't got to the end. And that's fine. I got to number 68 out of 129. And I'll just repeat what I said to you before. Anything which I didn't talk about in class will not be on your exam. However, I will put the whole PowerPoint onto EPRELE because it might help you with your CAPES. Because remember, you are all going to get the CAPES. That's right, yes. So have a good holiday. But after a few days, start thinking about working again because, you know, you're in the army now.